If Only by Amanda Watkins.
We led an ordinary, unremarkable life, Martin and I, and it suited us well. Married for nearly 30 years, Martin was the head of the science department at the local sixth form college, and I worked from home illustrating children's books. There were just the two of us at home most of the time these days. Our daughter, Laura, had finished at university and was at teacher training college. One sunny July morning 2 years ago, the doorbell rang and our lives changed forever. A policeman and policewoman were standing there, and I knew from the expressions on their faces that something horrible had happened. Our lovely Martin had been struck by a hit-and-run driver as he crossed the road on his way to the college. He dropped his car into the garage early for its MOT and walked the rest of the way. He was rushed into A&E, but nothing could be done. I couldn't take it in. Not Martin. The man I'd kissed goodbye a couple of hours earlier. Who'd got into the car laughing at the conversation we'd just had about our forthcoming holiday. The man who loved life. Not him, surely. Disbelief gave way to shock, followed by anger, then the grief that was to be my constant companion. The police were very kind and made tea and called Laura, who was staying with friends. She phoned Audrey, my closest friend since our school days. She was slightly eccentric, but always seemed to know what to do and was marvellous in a crisis. She swept in and basically took charge, gathered together the paperwork we needed for the registrar, contacted a funeral director, and did all the things I couldn't face because they made it all too real. After the funeral, well, life had to go on. Friends and family were wonderfully supportive, but they all had their lives to get on with. I got on with my work and drifted into a different kind of daily regime. The grief never leaves you, but you gain more control over it. You can compartmentalize it and push it to the back of your mind. Every now and then something will trigger it and take you by surprise. But something was eating away at me. I knew I shouldn't let it, but there was nothing I could do about it. I kept coming back to, if only I'd insisted on following him to the garage in my car, then I could have driven him to the college. And if only we'd had breakfast a little bit earlier, or a little bit later, then he wouldn't have been in that spot when that idiot drove round the corner. The if-onlys were endless. I knew it was silly and pointless to beat myself up about it, but I couldn't help it. A few seconds would have made all the difference. The year drifted on. Over the following months, Laura, Audrey and I slowly sorted Martin's clothes and other belongings, which of course meant many hours remembering, laughing and crying. In the autumn, Audrey insisted that I go with her to York for a few days. Oh, come on, Marion, pack your bag. It's time you spent some time away from the house. Well, she was right, of course. It was just what I needed. Christmas was hard, but at Easter, Audrey dragged me off to Geneva, and once again, she was right. I loved it. Summer came and went. Laura became a fully-fledged teacher and got a job in the science department at the local comprehensive school. Like Martin, she'd always had a particular fondness for physics. So when the college were looking for someone to take over physics classes for adults a couple of evenings a week to cover the tutor's maternity leave, she applied and got the job. In late August, Audrey said we should go to the Lake District for a few days. This was careful planning on her part, as the second anniversary of Martin's death was approaching, and I welcomed the distraction. Laura loved teaching at the school, and the adult physics course at the college seemed to be doing very well. She was looking for a small place of her own, but rents were so high, and I was more than happy to have her company at home. I was a bit puzzled, however, when I was doing a bit of shopping on the high street to bump into someone Martin used to work with years ago. "Hey, Marion," he called out, "how are you?" But I hadn't seen Michael Sturgis since Martin's funeral. We exchanged pleasantries for a few minutes, and then he said, "You're Laura's a chip off the old block, isn't she?" "Good heavens, Michael, how do you know Laura?" I said. "You haven't gone back to school, have you?" "In a way," he said. "I've enrolled for one of the evening physics classes, and she's our tutor. I think she'd be a good real-life Doctor Who." "What on earth do you mean?" I said. "Oh, Mustache, there's my bus," and off he ran. After dinner, I said, "I bumped into Michael Sturgis today." "Oh, yes," she said, "I'd forgotten you and Dad knew him. So what did he mean about you being a real-life Doctor Who?" I asked. "Oh, very funny," she said. "Have you ever heard of chronophysics or chronoportation?" "Me?" I said, more than somewhat surprised at the question. "No, dear, I can't say I have. You know, I've never been able to get my head around the sciences, or maths come to that." "Yes, I know," she said. "Well, they loosely come under the heading of quantum mechanics and are more by way of being theoretical rather than proven sciences. In other words, to put it into layman's terms, the science of possible time travel." I stared at her in disbelief. "No, not really," I said. "There's no such thing, surely." She explained. "Theories about time travel have been discussed for many years, even by Einstein and Stephen Hawking, who both thought that it might just be possible to go forward a little bit if one could find a way to travel faster than the speed of light, which nobody has so far. However, there's also a theory that travelling back could be achieved, not by speeding forward in a straight line, but spinning round at high speed, like the rotor. You know, that fairground attraction where they spin round so fast that people stick to the walls and the floors drop away, only you'd have to do it in a much smaller cylinder, like a very large barrel." "And you've been looking into this at your evening classes?" I asked. "Just out of interest," she said, "as a theoretical exercise, and it got us wondering if, with science and technology having moved on the way it has over the past 10 years, maybe, just maybe, it might be worth exploring again. But it's all on paper. No one is going to start building a time travel machine in their shed any time soon." Well, I don't know why, but our conversation started me feeling unsettled again. I was between commissions, so I arranged to meet Audrey for coffee the following day, and I told her about it. "It stirred up all those feelings of if only again," I said. "If only things had been different that morning. What if one could travel back in time? What would you do? What would you change?" Audrey sighed. "Marion, dear, for goodness sake, put these ideas out of your head," she said. You must live in the here and now or you'll go nuts. And what would you do if you found yourself back in your house on that morning? The chances of you bumping into yourself are terrifyingly high. And then what? You could spill coffee all down Martin's trousers, and he'd have to change. But how would you get your other self out of the kitchen to do it? No, and it's never going to happen anyway. It can never become possible, or we'd already know about it, wouldn't we? Think about it. There are so many things that have happened in our past that people would be rushing to change. Well, there'd be a long queue to stop Hitler for a start. Oh, you're right, I said. What's done is done. I'll get a grip and leave scientists to worry about time travel. That's my girl, said Audrey. Mind you, she said, if I could go back in time, I think I might have risked meeting my younger self and stopped myself from rushing down the aisle with Freddie Critchlow. I knew I'd made a mistake 3 weeks into the marriage. He was incredibly gorgeous to look at, but I wasn't the only one to think that. He did too. Other women swooned over him and he didn't exactly fight them off. And then I'd have to confront myself again so that I didn't marry that weak idiot Harry Barlow. I mean, he was nice enough, but Mummy ruled the roost. I lost count of the number of times we'd arranged to go out for a meal or to the theatre, and she'd phone up and say she needed him for this or that, and he'd go. I gave him an ultimatum, but smug, crafty Mummy won. Actually, I can't think of anyone, well, certainly not anyone I know, who wouldn't jump at the chance to travel back and change something. Well, you know, Audrey, I said, I've often wondered why you came back to sleepy old Newton Chase. You were the PA to a wealthy man. You travelled all over the world, stayed in fabulous hotels, and yet you came back here. True, she said. I did all those things, but I also had two disastrous marriages. And along the way, I met some amazing people, but I also met some truly awful human beings. My parents and my true friends were here. And you know what? I always envied what you and Martin had. Oh, if only I'd seen him first. In your dreams, lady, I said. For the record, he saw me before either of us spotted him. Oh, look. Oh, if only I'd seen those eclairs before I chose the scone.
If Only was written and read by Amanda Watkins.